The book of Job cultivates admiration for Job, but Job questions divine justice. Is the book of Job trying to cultivate an admiration of the person that challenges God? What happens when there's a clash between major biblical theology and a major biblical hero? What happens? Well, that's what happens in the book of Job. Satan's a cynic. Satan doesn't believe that Job is truly good. Satan believes that the goodness of Job is not a reflection of the power of his character, but the quality of his circumstances. Job that quotes God, that's backed by God, is the greatest criticizer of God. How is it that the criticizer of God is supported by God? What is this book doing in the Bible?
The Tanakh has three parts, right? Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim. The five books of Moses, the Torah, Nevi'im, which is actually divided into two, the whole historiographic part of the Tanakh, Joshua, Judges, Kings, all the great stories, and all the preachings of the prophets, Yirmiyahu, Yishayahu, Yechezkel, Terei Asar. That's the Nevi'im. And then the Kaf in Tanakh is for part three, the Ketuvim. Ezra, Nehemiah, Daniel, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job, Esther. And among those, there's 24 books, three parts, in one common denominator. And that is the assumption of the editors of the Bible that it's a sacred book because in some way it records God's will. As someone put it, the rabbinic understanding of the Bible is a letter of God to humanity. And if we want to understand God, understand God's will, we have to investigate and study that letter. And that letter has three parts, and every word in all those parts is divine. That is the position of the Bible itself. Now, it doesn't mean that every word in the Bible has the same level of prophecy. The five books of Moses are the direct words of God. The Nevi'im are prophets that spoke the words of God, but somehow the words of God were mediated through them. And then the Ketuvim is what Chazal call, what the rabbis call, Ruach HaKodesh. So these are words inspired by God. But all these words together are part of the letter of God to humanity. That is how the Bible presents itself. That's how the editors of the Bible saw the Bible. Among the 24 books in the Bible, divided into three parts, among them is the book of Job, or in Hebrew, Iyov. I might call him Iyov. So when I say Iyov, I mean Job. And so among those 25 books is Job, and I think the most important interpretation of the book of Job is the interpretation of the editors of the Tanakh. I don't know who they were. We don't know. It's a black hole of Jewish history. But the people who decided to canonize Iyov, the people who decided to put the book of Iyov as a part of the Tanakh, that was their interpretation of Job. Job is sacred. The words of the book of Job are in some way inspired by God. This session, session number one in our five sessions, is to try to understand what does it mean that the book of Job is a part of the Bible. Next session, we'll start reading the book of Job. Now I want to ask about the context of Job. It's a book in the Bible. And one way to think about this session is the following question. What is this book doing in the Bible? Or a different way to ask it, what is the fact that this book is in the Bible? What does it mean about this book? The book of Job, the book of Iyov. So, it's a divine book. It's in the Bible. But the rabbis had a hard time with the book of Job. Now, before we go to the rabbis, I mentioned the rabbis, the heroes of the Talmud and the Midrash. Now, Judaism is shaped by, not by the Bible and not by the Talmud. It's shaped by both the Bible and the Talmud. Judaism is shaped by two worlds, the Tanakh and the Talmud, or the whole periphery of the Talmud, the whole rabbinic literature, the Mishnah, the Gemara, the Midrash. Now, these two worlds, the worlds of the rabbis and the worlds of the prophets, the Tanakh and the Talmud, they're separate worlds, and I just want to offer some very trivial distinctions about these worlds. The Bible, as I opened, presents itself as the words of God. The Talmud does not present itself as the direct words of God. It sees itself differently. And a good way to capture this is that if the Tanakh, if the Bible, is a product of revelation, the Talmud and the rabbinic books are a product of interpretation. So we have two worlds, Tanakh, Talmud, revelation, and interpretation. Now that difference creates a different character. Every book has a different character. The heroes of the Tanakh are obviously the prophets, the Nevi'im, the people who speak the words of God. The heroes, the main players in the Talmud are not prophets. The Talmud claims that prophecy stopped. That's the main position of the Talmud. Not the only one, but the main one. And the main heroes, the main players of the Talmud are not the prophets, but the scholars, the rabbis. But I think the most important difference is the genre, the structure of the text. The Tanakh is about preachings. Moshe preaches to the people. He says the words of God to the people. Jeremiah speaks the words of God, and he preaches the words of God to the people. Ko amar Hashem, this is what God told me to tell you. In the Talmud, there is no preachings. They're not shouting, they're not yelling, they're not preaching, they're doing something else, the rabbis. They are talking. They're participating in a conversation. The first Mishnah of Masechet Brachot, of Tractat Brachot, goes like this. One rabbi thinks that we're supposed to stop saying Shema by the end of the first shift of the priests in the Mikdash. A second rabbi thinks we have till midnight. A third rabbi thinks we have till the dawn of the morning. Rabbi Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Eliezer, other Chachamim, it's a conversation. In other words, the Bible is about monologues. It's a canonization of all these different monologues. Prophets speaking the words of God to the crowd. It's the Bible is a monologue. It's a collection of monologues. The Talmud is a dialogue. It's a conversation between human beings. And here we have it. Revelation and interpretation, monologue, dialogue. Dialogue about what? About the meaning of the monologue. It's a dialogue, it's a debate, it's a conversation, it's a disagreement about the meaning of the Bible. So the Bible presents God's words, and the Talmud is an attempt to understand those words and understand it through a debate, through a conversation. Till now, this is all, I think, pretty trivial. Two worlds, different nature. One is about the words of God, the other is a human attempt to understand the words of God through a conversation, through a dialogue. It's a dialogue about the divine monologue. Now, these are quite, I think, trivial distinctions. There's only one problem with these distinctions. They don't work. And they don't work because of one reason, and that reason is the book of Job. You see, the book of Job, Sefer Yov, cracks these distinctions. It blurs the difference between the genre of the Bible and the Tanakh and the genre of the Talmud. How does it do that? Well, to understand how the book of Job challenges all these distinctions and it blurs the differences between rabbinic literature and the biblical prophetic literature, we have to understand the basic structure of the book of Job. So now an introduction, the structure of the book of Job. The book of Job, one of the 24 books of the Bible, is divided into 42 chapters. There's 42 membet parakim, 42 chapters in the book of Job. But the book of Job, I think, should be divided into three parts. Okay. Part one is a conversation, a very bizarre conversation. We'll study it carefully next week, between God and Satan and Satan. Okay, that's part one. So here we have part one, you see, is a conversation between God and Satan. Okay? That's a conversation that lasts for two chapters. Okay. Part three is the last four chapters. It's a conversation between God and Job. So part three is God and Job are having a conversation. Can we see this? Okay. Now part two, so which is the heart of the book of Job, is a conversation between Job and three friends. So it's Job and his, let's call it F, his three friends. Okay. Actually, it's three plus one. There's three friends, and in the end, there's someone that joins them. So here's the structure. Three conversations. Part one, two chapters, God and Satan. Very bizarre. We'll talk about it. Part two, 36 chapters. Sorry, 36 chapters. God and Job and his friends. Then part three, four chapters between God and Job. So this is the structure. And what is the structure about? Well, here's how it goes. My assumption is that this is the heart of Job, right? The conversation between Job and his friends, and now this is what it's about. So roughly, this is how the story goes. Job is a good person. God testifies that Job is a very good person. Ishtam v'yashar v'yare Elohim v'sar mera. I won't go into the heap. He's a very good person. He's the perfect person. He's tam. He's blameless. He never sinned. That's how God describes him. Satan challenges God. Satan says, I'm not really sure that Job is really good. It's not that his nature is good. It's not that his character is good. He just has it good. And that's why he's good. God doesn't agree with Satan. And they decide to resolve their conversation, their disagreement, through testing Job. How do you test Job? Well, as we all know from life, this is something I know from the military, but we all know this from life. Many times, people's character is tested when things get very tough. When things are hard, when things are tough, when things are not easy anymore, the true character of people is exposed. Satan has an idea. Let's make things very hard on Job. And let's see what his character is really about. Let's expose his true nature by making things horrible for him. So that's exactly what they do. God inflicts pain on Job. All his kids die. I know it's horrible, but we're going to go into this with more depth next week. He becomes very sick, and all his wealth is taken away from him. Okay, that's part one. Part two, Job is suffering. He lost all his children, all his wealth. He's poor, and his health is taken away from him. Three of his friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, that's their names, they come to comfort him. They sit with him. Job opens his mouth and he says, I want to tell you something. My life is not worth living, but then he makes another theological statement. Life itself is not worth living. Life is meaningless. And he builds a very interesting argument why life is empty. Life is meaningless. Life is not worth living. His friends disagree. They say life is worth living. And they bring some arguments to back the idea that life is worth living. Job also says that he says to his friends, I want you to know something. Tam ani, I am righteous. I didn't do anything bad. I wasn't supposed to deserve this. And as a result, God did not do justice to me. And you know what? He makes a larger conclusion. God does not govern this world with justice and fairness, and equality. His friends don't accept that. They challenge that. They have a conversation. This is how the conversation works. Job presents his thesis. Life is not worth it. And it's a thesis about a lot, about life after death, about the meaning of life, about the goodness of God. He presents his thesis. And Job's friends challenge his thesis. It starts with Eliphaz. He answers Job. And then Bildad. He offers his response to Job. And then Zophar, also he, the third friend, offers his response to Job. And then Job responds to their response. And then they respond to his response. This is a cycle that goes around three times. He makes an argument. They challenge his argument. He offers a contra-argument three times. And then after this is over, a fourth friend, Elihu, appears and offers. He challenges the friends regarding the way that they are challenging Job. What I'm trying to say is that Job is an argument. Job is a sophisticated, the book of Job, the heart of the book of Job. Yes, the heart, the 36 chapters and the heart of the book of Job. It's 36, 2, 36, and 4. Comes out in the end, 42, yes. So the 36 chapters in the heart of Job are a sophisticated dialogue. Now, this is where it becomes interesting. It's a dialogue inside the Tanakh. Now, I thought the dialogue is the genre of the rabbis. The rabbis in the Talmud, we have disagreements. We have a dialogue. In the Bible, we're supposed to have monologues. And there's a reason why we have that distinction. The Bible represents the words of God. The Talmud is an argument about the words of God. But here in the book of Job, we have not a dialogue about the Bible. We have a dialogue in the Bible. It's almost an oxymoron, a biblical dialogue. Now, it gets worse. What does it mean that there is a dialogue not about the Bible, but in the Bible? What does it mean? Well, if the words of the Bible are inspired by God, so it's a disagreement between different representations of God. This is not my interpretation. This is the rabbis of the Talmud. In Baba Batra, in Tractat, in Masechet Baba Batra, there's a braita where the rabbis share that there's seven Gentiles in the Bible that were prophets. Five of them are in the book of Job. Job, his three friends, and Elihu, the fourth guy that comes along later. So, and I understand why the rabbis thought that they were all prophets. One, because Job was a prophet. God reveals himself to him, right? In part three. Eliphaz, by the way, was a prophet. He describes, we'll see that, how God revealed himself to him. But the best way to understand why they're all prophets is that's the interpretation, as I started, of the editors of the Tanakh. When they put these people as characters of the Tanakh, they believe that their words are somehow inspired by God. Now, this gets very weird, which means this is a disagreement between people that represent God's words. According to the rabbis in Baba Batra, it's a disagreement between prophets. According to the editors of the Bible, it's a disagreement between people carrying the words of God. The reason why this is weird is because many of us are used to thinking the following way. There is disagreements between rabbis about the meaning of the Bible, but there can't be a disagreement inside the Bible. And here is the news. The news of the book of Job is that there is a disagreement inside the Bible. It's not a disagreement about the words of God. It's a disagreement between different representations of the words of God. What does that mean? What does that mean that the book of Job blurs the distinction between Talmud and Bible, offers a biblical dialogue, and exposes us to a disagreement not about the meaning of the words of God, but disagreement within the divine words of the Bible? What does that mean? Well, there must be a theology that can explain this. But today, in session one, I'm not answering answers. I'm only asking questions. And that was my first question. The oxymoron of a biblical dialogue. What does that mean? I'd like to move now to a second question. That was a hard question. I would like to move to an even harder question. Let's dig a little bit deeper into the book of Job before we open it. What's the relationship between the book of Job and the other chapters, books of the Bible? Well, readers of Job And by next week, we'll all be readers of Job. We'll be starting to read Job. I think that we all have a similar experience when we see Job, learn about Job, and get to know Job. And it's the experience that we start loving him. Leo Strauss said once that when you read a book, don't only ask, what does the book say? Ask the second question, maybe the more important question. Don't only ask, what does the book say? Ask, what does a book do? What does it do to its readers? Well, my opinion is that the book of Job cultivates an admiration for Job. He is definitely the good guy of the book of Job. You can't not admire Job when you are reading Job. And we'll see why. But for now, just take my word for it. It's impossible to read Job without to be Job's fan. And if you're Job's fan, maybe you become a fan of Job's theology. And Job's theology and Job's statements are something like this. He says in one chapter, Eretz nitzna beyad rasha. God neglected the world, and the world is governed by the wicked, by the evil. He also says, Hirba p'tza'ai chinam. God bruised me for nothing. He also says, Job says, Tam v'rasha hu mechale. God does not make any, he doesn't distinguish between good people, bad people. He is blind to our ethics. He kills us all. Job is frustrated. Job questions divine justice. So here's the problem. The book of Job cultivates admiration for Job, but Job questions divine justice. Is the book of Job trying to cultivate an admiration of the person that challenges God? Well, what Job really is doing, he's not challenging God, he's challenging a theory. It's the following theory, a theory we all know. Good things are supposed to happen to good people. Bad things are supposed to happen to bad people. There's supposed to be some kind of a symmetry between our biography and our destiny. When we're good, good things happen to us. When we're bad, bad things will happen to us. That's a theory we all know from where? From the Bible itself. Leviticus, Deuteronomy, the book of Judges, Prophets, Psalms, Proverbs, they all echo. It's the classic biblical theology. It's the way the Bible understands the reward system. It's fair. It's based on justice. If good things happen to you, you must have done something good. If bad things happen to you, you must have done something bad. Job challenges that, which means, I want to reach my first conclusion, Job is a biblical hero admired by a biblical book that challenges the biblical theory. What happens when there's a clash between major biblical theology and a major biblical hero? What happens? Well, that's what happens in the book of Job. But it gets even weirder. It gets even weirder. Because the problem of the book of Job, it's not only that Job, a biblical hero, challenges biblical theology. Job challenges Job. Let me explain this. Job is a figure, is a character that appears outside of the book of Job. He appears one time outside the book of Job. And that happens in the book of Ezekiel and Yechezkel. So it'll be interesting to learn how Yechezkel understands Job. And in light of that, to understand the project of the book of Job. Because it turns out there's two biblical Jobs, Ezekiel's and the book of Job's. So, and what's more interesting is that Ezekiel, Yechezkel, mentions Job in the chapter where he discusses divine providence and his understanding of the reward system. So, here's how it goes. This is the only time I want to read a text. I want to open in this session. Ezekiel 14, where he suddenly mentions Job. Now, you could open if you want Ezekiel 14. I'll be reading from verse 12. And while you find in your Tanakh, in your Bible, Ezekiel, Yechezkel 14, I want to give an introduction to Ezekiel 14. So what Ezekiel does, it's not the only chapter where he does this, he also does this in 18, but Ezekiel is one of the prophets that has to refine biblical theology. He has to refine the reward system theology, that good things happen to good people, bad things to bad people. And here's his problem. The problem is that the language of the reward system in the Torah is collective. Moshe, God, speaks to the people and says, if you, as a collective, as a people, you'll be good, great things will happen to you. You'll be victorious in your wars, you'll have wealth, you'll be prosperous as a nation. If you'll violate the covenant with God, bad things will happen to you. You'll lose wars, your enemies will destroy you, crush you, the temple will be destroyed, you'll have famine, all these bad things. But it's a collective reward system. But that means, what happens, here's the thing. What happens if I'm living among, within a very bad, evil, wicked collective and I'm a good person? Will I be punished for the sins of the collective? Or vice versa? What happens if I'm a bad person living within a very righteous collective? Will I enjoy the blessings of the collective, all the good things that are happening for the collective, even though I'm bad? Well, Ezekiel addresses this question, and his answer is no. And what Ezekiel offers is privatization of the reward system. He says good things will happen to good people personally. Bad things will happen to bad people personally. And the way he privatizes the reward system, he does it through using a shocking example. The example of Job. Let's read. So I'll be reading in Hebrew for one reason. The Tanakh was written in Hebrew. Also a second reason, I feel more comfortable reading the Tanakh in Hebrew. Feel free to stay with me in Hebrew. I'll explain myself. But if you don't feel comfortable, feel free to follow me in English. So Ezekiel chapter 14, verse 12. Vidvar Adonai Elai Lemor. God appears to him and speaks to him. Ben Adam. O mortal, Eretz ki techtali li molmal, vanatiti yadi alea, v'shivarti la matelachem, v'shlachti ba ra'av, v'chrati ba mimena adam ve'behema. If a collective, Eretz, which means like representative of a nation, sins to me, I will punish them. And he speaks here specifically about famine. They will suffer from famine or maybe an economic crisis. Then he said, but what happens if there's some righteous people among them? Will they be saved? Will the collective be saved because of those righteous people? So this is how he says that. Verse 14. Vayu shloshet ha'anashim ha'ele betochan. There's three people among them. Noach, Daniel, ve'Iyov. So what happens if there's a collective and there's three righteous people and he names them? Like he gives, like, what is the epitome of a righteous person? Noach, right? Ish tzadik tamim. Daniel. Scholars say it's not the book Daniel of the book of Daniel. So let's put him aside for a minute. And Iyov. And then he says, Hema betzidkatam inatzlu nafsham ne'um Adonai Elohim. He will continue with this line. But I'll stop here and explain how he continues. He says, even if there is someone righteous like Noah or Job within your collective, it's not that God, because he wants to save them, he'll save the collective. No. He'll save them and punish the collective. That's what he will do. So what he's saying is that if you're a good person, you're not going to save the collective. You're going to only save yourself. Reward system is private. It's privatized by Ezekiel. Now, let's think about this 1 minute. Noach is a good example for that, right? God was very angry. Noah, right? He was very angry. He wants to destroy the world, but there's a righteous person, Noach. So instead of Noach saving the world, God destroys the world and saves Noach. And he mentions Daniel, which is, we don't know who he is. He's probably not the biblical Daniel. And he mentions Job, but the problem is the story of Noach works with the example of Ezekiel. But the story of Job is the opposite of the example of Ezekiel. It's not that Job was saved and everyone else was suffering. But when you read the book of Job, you mean everyone else is not suffering. And only Job suffers. It's not that he is separated from everyone else and saved from the suffering. He is separated from everyone else in order to suffer. There's a contradiction between the Job of Ezekiel and the Job of Job. Now, I want to think about this, because why does Ezekiel mention Job and Noach and Daniel? It's because he obviously assumes that the people he's talking to know who they are. Because when you speak to a crowd, you have to use metaphors or examples that the crowd knows, or else they can't really understand what you're saying. Someone told me once, Micha, you can't ever speak to an American crowd because you don't know baseball. You can't use baseball examples or football. And they're right. I still don't know baseball. And thank you, Tikva, for letting me speak to an American crowd. But when you prepare a speech, you have to choose examples that you assume everyone will know. Ezekiel assumes everybody knows that there's a righteous person called Job. He's legendary. And this is what I learned from Ezekiel. Job was a legend. And it's a perfect legend. A legend about a good person, that everything was good for him. And if there was a legend about a good person, that everything went well for him, the book of Job, what it really is, it cracks the legend. Like the book of Job says, there is the fantasy of Job and there is the reality of Job. The fantasy is wrong. The fantasy is, I see a good person that had a great life. In reality, he was a good person that had a horrible life. So we have the Job of the book of Job and the Job of Yechezkel, which represents the legend of the book of Job for the rest of the Bible. So Job challenges the narrative of Job. That's what this is about. And I think this captures and represents the broader tension we have here. That the book of Job challenges biblical theology. The legend of Job is supposed to represent the biblical theology. Breaking the myth of Job challenges biblical theology. Good things don't really happen to good people. So we're back to square one. We're back to the tension between a biblical hero and a biblical narrative. But I think we should offer a more sophisticated understanding of what's happening here. And that is, the biblical narrative, the biblical reward system, is not only challenged by the book of Job. It's also challenged by most of the prophets. But it's challenged in a more sophisticated way. Isaiah criticizes the way people understand religion. And he says to the people in Isaiah chapter 1, for example, that they have a misunderstanding of what God wants from us. They think God wants us to perform rituals, but that's not what God wants. Mi bikesh mikem eile remos chatzerai. He says, God does not want the rituals of the temple. What does he want? He wants social sensitivity. He wants compassion. He wants us to take care of three types of categories: orphans, widows, and foreigners. Ger yetom ve'almana. Isaiah tries to reform the way people think about religion. It's ethics above rituals. That's Isaiah. Jeremiah says the same, but he takes it one step forward. In Jeremiah chapter 7, you have this in your sources if you want to study this later. Jeremiah criticizes the theology of the temple that goes like this. People believe that by performing rituals in the temple, they're protected. Nothing bad will happen to them. Okay, so they have a certain understanding of the reward system. That when you perform the rituals in a correct way, the korbanot, the sacrifice, in the temple, you're immune. Nothing bad will happen to you. And Jeremiah says, they're right, there is a reward system, but they don't understand the reward system correctly. You are not protected from destruction just because you perform the rituals in the temple. That's not true. And you misunderstood God's words and God's attentions, and you misunderstood what religion is about. Religion is about protecting the ger, yetom, ve'almana. And if you do that, you're protected. I want to offer my explanation for the prophets. The ger, the foreigner, the immigrant, is a person that's usually unprotected, and the larger society could take advantage of him or her. They're not protected. An orphan has no parents to protect him or her, so people can take advantage of them. The widow is not protected by her husband and those societies. That meant she's exposed and not protected. So what is Jeremiah, Isaiah, the prophets are saying? You want divine protection? Protect the unprotected. Here's the equation, the way I learned to articulate it. Only when you protect the unprotected, you are protected. Follow me? But if you don't protect the unprotected, you're exposed and you're not protected. Rituals won't protect you. Ethics will protect you. So what are the prophets doing? They're refining the reward system. They're saying, yes, good things happen to good people, but when we say good people, we don't mean people that are from, people that practice the religious ceremonies and rituals in the temple the right, accurate way. No, that's not what we mean. It's not about rituals. It's about ethics. That's a very important motif, maybe one of the most dominant motifs in the preachings and the monologues of the prophets. So I would say the prophets criticize the classic understanding of reward system, and they refine it. Jeremiah offers a critique of the reward system. Job wasn't the first. What Job does is more radical. You see, the book of Job describes Job, and I realize we have 2 more minutes, right? So I realize the book of Job does something else. No, actually, Andrew spoke about, I think we have 4 minutes. So the book of Job does something else. In Job chapter 21, this is a chapter we will be studying. It's an autobiography. Job describes who he was before the catastrophe happened. And he says, "Einaim hayiti le'iver." I was the eyes for blind people. I would take care of widows. I would watch over orphans. Tzedek yibishtani, I would wear justice. He was the epitome of justice. When God says about Job, he meant he was ethical, he was moral, he had compassion, he was sensitive socially to the people who were unprotected. He's the one that protected them. Job is the personification of everything the prophets ever wanted a person to be. And yet, the catastrophe happened to him. All his children died. His health was taken away from him. Everything he owned was destroyed. This takes me to this final conclusion. The prophets offer a critique of the classic understanding of the reward system. But the book of Job is a critique of the critique. It says it doesn't work. The prophets say rituals don't work. Ethics do. They do protect you. Job, the book of Job says, also ethics don't protect you. You'll protect the unprotected, and God will still inflict his suffering on you, pain on you. Job is the critique of the biblical theology. Which takes me to my last conclusion. We have a biblical theology presented in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy. We have the prophets criticizing it and refining it. And we have Job criticizing the works of the prophets. Which means the book of Job is in a very deep, intimate conversation with the other voices in the Bible. Which means my first remark was that the book of Job is a dialogue. It's a dialogue within the Bible. My conclusion here is broader. It's not only that the book of Job is a dialogue within the Bible, the book of Job itself turns the Bible into a dialogue. It turns the entire Bible into a theological conversation between the classic understanding of the reward system, the critique of the prophets, and the critique of the critique. The book of Job, just by being in the Bible, is a dialogue in the Bible, but it transforms the entire Bible and then turns the Bible into a dialogue. This is what I try to establish today. 3 points. 1, the book of Job is a biblical dialogue. What does that mean? 2, Job is a biblical hero criticizing the biblical narrative reward system, the biblical theology. And 3, the book of Job as a project is a critique of the prophetic critique of the reward system. That was in very, very broad remarks about the relationship between Job and the Bible. God is proud of Job. God created Job, and many times creators are proud of their creation.
People who write books are proud of their books. Carpenters are proud of their chairs and tables. And sometimes they show off. God says to Satan, have you seen Job? Subtext, I finally got one right.